somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, Episode 0. Why Free Speech? Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. If you're the kind of podcast listener who has no patience for introductions and just wants to dive straight into the action, you can skip what I'm about to say and wait for, or if you're listening after February 1st, jump to Episode 1 on Ancient Athens. But if you do want a bit of background on why I'm doing this podcast and what to expect, stick around for the next 20 minutes or so. So why am I doing this podcast? I was born in liberal and democratic Denmark in 1978. I was 11 when the Berlin Wall came tumbling down and had just entered my teens when the Soviet Union suddenly disappeared from the map. In those 13 years, the number of free countries worldwide, as measured by Freedom House, had grown from 43 to 79 and outgrew those run by dictators and autocrats. And when I graduated from law school in 2003, the populations of 89 states on all continents breathed free air. Now, an integral part of living in a free country is the ability of citizens, media, and civil society to speak freely. And from 1980 until 2003, the number of countries with a free press grew from 51 to 78. Or put differently, in 1980, 34% of the world's then 161 countries had a free press. In 2003, 41% of the world's 193 countries had newspapers free to criticize their own governments and inform their citizens without censorship. So I not only have the good fortune of being born in one of the most free and open democracies in the world, I also belong to a generation that could almost literally take free speech and democracy for granted and expect these values to become universally entrenched. At least, that's what I thought at the time. This begs the question of why a youngish man should become obsessed with a principle which I'm able to exercise daily with no fear of censorship or punishment. To be honest, I wasn't particularly interested in free speech for much of this period. In 2004, I couldn't know that this year would mark the beginning of a constant decline in global press freedom lasting until this day. From the high water mark in 2003, when 41% of the world's countries had a free press, we're down to 31% in 2017. Or put differently, only 13% of the world's 7.4 billion people enjoy free speech, while 45% live in countries where censorship is the norm. Even so, more than half of the world's population across all continents think being able to speak one's mind without censorship is very important. From a high of 71% of Americans to a low of 43% in the Middle East, according to Pew Research. But it was not until cozy liberal Denmark became the epicenter of a global battle of values over the limits of free speech that I started really thinking long and hard about this principle. In 2005, Danish newspaper Jyllandsposten published cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Initially, not a lot happened. But in early 2006, a global crisis erupted, setting in motion a chain of explosive events whose aftershocks still rock the world from time to time. What surprised me most about the whole affair was not the reaction of angry mobs in Cairo and Karachi, nor governments and autocracies demanding censorship and apologies in order to appease extremists. What stunned me was the reaction of leading intellectuals, journalists, and politicians who, like me, had grown up in secular democracies where religion had long been fair game for artists, satirists, and writers. Many of these people who relied on free speech for a living now suddenly insisted that free speech should not be abused to offend religious feelings of minorities. All the while, religious extremists used AK-47s as rejoinders to the strokes of pens. Even self-professed defenders of human rights were suddenly getting cold feet about defending the freedom that had been the gold standard when the human rights movement gave a voice to dissidents behind the Iron Curtain. Free speech became a hotly contested political battleground in the democratic West, where voices who saw themselves as progressive suddenly argued in favor of internalizing religious dogmas as the moral, or even sometimes legal, limits of free speech in secular and liberal democracies. But as controversies over immigration, multiculturalism, and religion continued in the following decade, I noticed another pattern. Many of those who had been loudly in favor of almost limitless free speech during the Khartoum crisis now rushed to advocate limits on speech that offended their core beliefs, such as religious speech seen as veering too far from secular democratic ideals or too close to sympathy for terrorism. Even cartoons were fair game, provided their target was the in-group and not the out-group. Suddenly, former free speech fundamentalists were insisting that tolerance of the intolerant had become dangerously naive and that free speech might not be so important after all. At least not when used to advance the wrong ideas and values. This pattern of selective outrage and free speech buddhism repeated itself whenever new battlegrounds sprung up over free speech. On universities, on hate speech, on social media and fake news, to name but a few current controversies. Few seemed willing to defend free speech on principle, preferring to advance this freedom mostly when it supported their underlying sympathies, only to butt out when used by their ideological opponents. Free speech had gone tribal. And outside the West, countries that many hoped would ensure the universal entrenchment of free speech have moved ever more hastily in the opposite direction. At the end of 2017, 262 journalists sat imprisoned, the highest number ever recorded by Reporters Without Borders. 73 journalists were imprisoned in Turkey alone. Since 2003, 21 journalists have been murdered in Russia. China has managed to use the digital age to increase its iron grip on information and expression. Toppling the Great Firewall has long prospects. Apostasy or blasphemy is punishable by death in 13 countries, all members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. In 2016, not a single country on the African continent was rated free when it comes to press freedom. Latin America has also seen losses, most seriously in Venezuela. Perhaps free speech had only been sacred in democracies because no one had seriously challenged it for several decades. If so, it would not be the first time in history. In the introduction to his classic work, A History of Freedom of Thought, Irish historian J.B. Burry wrote,
"At present in most civilized countries, freedom of speech is taken as a matter of course and seems a perfectly simple thing. We are so accustomed to it that we look on it as a natural right. But this right has been acquired only in recent times, and the way to its attainment has lain through lakes of blood."
Those words were written in 1912. A mere 2 years later, the Great War would result in new lakes of blood, deeper than at any other point in previous human history, as well as massive repression of dissent, blanket censorship, and surveillance of global communications. The emergence of totalitarian ideologies, another cataclysmic world war, immediately followed by a cold one, created new bloodshed and repression. That was the background for the golden age of free speech I grew up in, and which may or may not be ending. Burry's words gave me food for thought. It seemed to me that very often arguments for and against free speech were couched in very abstract terms and based on assumptions that were rarely put to any test, but simply asserted as a matter of fact, or dogma. This includes a lot of my own writing, by the way. A typical argument over free speech might go something like this. History shows how dangerous it is to let governments restrict free speech. Just think of Nazi Germany. To be countered with, history shows the dangers of allowing too much free speech. Just think of Nazi Germany. And the argument might then end with each side pulling out some of the oldest and most tired memes of free speech discussions. Free speech defenders will self-righteously exclaim, "I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." Thinking they've just quoted Voltaire, when really it was the words of his 20th century biographer, Beatrice Evelyn Hall. Those in favor of this or that restriction will knowingly remind everyone that free speech doesn't include the right to shout fire in a crowded theater. Oblivious to the fact that they're quoting, out of context, a line by former Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes used to justify the conviction of a socialist for opposing the draft through peaceful pamphleteering. If free speech really is so important a principle, it seemed clear to me that we owe ourselves to gain a fuller understanding about where this principle came from, how it was developed, and who had been its historical friends and enemies. If nothing else, then to give ourselves the necessary historical context and awareness needed to escape the narrow-minded tribalism and opportunism that fuels so much discussion on free speech. Voltaire may not have been ready to sacrifice his life for free speech, but many others have been willing to pay with their life or freedom for the right to speak their minds. I wanted to find out who these people were and what motivated them. Do those who have fought for free speech across the ages have something in common, despite the many different causes their speech was exercised in favor of? Were they all heroic principled champions of timeless ideals, or as prone to the political and religious tribalism of their day as we are in our current age? And what about the censors and hecklers? Do democratic governments panicking over fake news and populism in the 21st century have any commonalities with Athenians panicking over threats to their democracy in the 5th century BC? Do modern autocrats still use the same playbook as those of emperors, popes, and absolutist rulers in past centuries? And were religious extremists executing heretics in late antiquity and the Middle Ages motivated by the same impulses as modern jihadists willing to execute blasphemous cartoonists? I also wanted to delve into the past to find out what role free speech played in the struggles for the values that define the aspirations of modern democracies. Full suffrage, equality of the sexes, and the emancipation and empowerment of minorities. Values that some today think are threatened by free speech. I started my historical research with co-authoring a book on the history of free speech in Denmark from the Reformation until today, which came out in 2016. It's in Danish and more than 1,000 pages, so go ahead if you have a few years to kill. But then I was struck by the fact that very few books on the global history of free speech have been written. The maverick American journalist I.F. Stone set out to write one in the 1970s. But every time he dug into one historical period, he realized he had to dig deeper still, and so he ended up in ancient Athens. He never managed to move on, becoming so obsessed with the Athenian democracy's conviction of Socrates that in his retirement he taught himself ancient Greek to study the sources himself. This resulted in a book that even historians had to take note of, but left us short of a fuller historical account of free speech. I very much aim to progress further than I.F. Stone, and have already made it to late antiquity. But then again, I haven't stopped to teach myself Greek, Latin, or Arabic. So now I've given you the background for doing this podcast, which I'm currently producing from New York, where I'm lucky enough to be a visiting scholar at Columbia's Global Freedom of Expression Center, supported by FIRE. What follows is some information about the format and some housekeeping. The name of the podcast mentions the history of free speech, but really, it's a history of freedom of expression. Well, that sounds too clumsy. But what I'm really interested in is the restrictions imposed on human beings expressing their thoughts and ideas on whatever subject, political, religious, scientific, and in whatever form or medium, writing, speech, art, online, offline, alone, or through assembly and association. So when I use the words free speech, you should generally think freedom of expression. Legal purists might argue that free speech really only covers restrictions imposed by governments, not by private actors. I don't subscribe to such a narrow view, and neither does modern human rights law. Free speech can also be affected by private actors, such as wealthy businesses or oligarchs, religious extremists or drug cartels, using their power to enforce self-censorship. I'll use the word censorship frequently, and I'll use it to describe both pre-publication restrictions, such as licensing, as well as subsequent penalties or sanctions, such as convictions for blasphemy. I'm mainly interested in a practical, more than an abstract and theoretical history of free speech. Philosophers, political theorists, and theologians will no doubt find my treatment of some of the great thinkers and ideas that have been crucial for the battles over and development of free speech frustratingly superficial. When I focus on Socrates, I zoom in on the trial, not the larger philosophical questions raised by him. Also, I don't believe I can give a satisfactory account of why and where historical limits on free speech have been imposed if I don't exemplify it. This means I will sometimes quote material that some may find offensive, obscene, or hurtful. This also goes for the supporting material on freespeechhistory.com. So consider this a general trigger warning. Let me also be upfront about my shortcomings. I'm a lawyer specialized in human rights, not a historian. I've done my utmost in researching the episodes, and I've also consulted experts and used research assistants. But inevitably, historians and other experts on the periods and themes covered in the podcast will find my treatment lacking important context, detail, and nuanced understanding. With each episode, I'll upload a list of the most relevant literature that I've used to freespeechhistory.com, so you can check out my sources and determine whether I've done a good enough job in terms of research, selection, and interpretation. And of course, I'm narrating a history, not the history of free speech. I invite those who have important contributions or corrections to comment on freespeechhistory.com and on the show's Facebook and Twitter accounts. If you catch me making glaring mistakes, which is probably inevitable, I'll make corrections in the upcoming episodes and or online. What about my biases? If you Google my name, you'll find a number of articles and op-eds arguing for a robust protection of free speech. So there's no point trying to hide my prejudice, which of course you should take into account. But any honest investigation is meaningless if the conclusion is given. So I aim to check my confirmation bias and be as objective and inclusive as I can when it comes to sources. I have already gained new insights that have changed the way I think about free speech and its justification. And I cannot imagine that my thinking on the topic will remain exactly the same as today when I'm finished, although I don't expect to be won over to the side of Inquisition and censorship. As I'm speaking, I have produced 4 episodes and have a synopsis on how I will proceed. I plan to release a new episode every 2 weeks, with breaks for the usual holidays, acts of God, etc. Each regular episode will be narrated by me. I'll follow a general chronological arc, broken up by thematic episodes. But I'll also produce a number of expert opinions, where real experts get to weigh in and expand on some of the issues tackled or missed in previous episodes. Well, that's the plan anyway. I've already deviated quite a bit from my original plan, as I discovered new material and stories that deserve to be included. And I invite you to become my co-editors of this journey. If you have ideas on events or periods that should be covered, I'd love to hear from you, and I'll keep an open mind about deviating from my plan and exploring new avenues. Although entire new episodes require a lot of time and research, and may not always be feasible. With that, I hope you'll delve into episode 1 on free speech in ancient Athens, which I'll release in a week on February 1st. If you're not already familiar with this topic, I promise that it will give you new and surprising perspectives on free speech that are as relevant today as they were almost 2,500 years ago.